Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit SurreyFarms.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb, coming to you from Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Julia Tertian. Off the air, I write about food, and my favorite part about what I do is finding out the stories behind great recipes, restaurants, and more. On the air, I get to bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life by having these conversations with some of the most interesting women in the world of food. You can listen to the show every Monday at 1 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org or download it anytime on iTunes. On today's show, I'm so thrilled to be joined by Dana Cowan. Dana is not only the longstanding editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine, she's also a new cookbook author. Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen, her first cookbook, is out this fall, and I'm so delighted that Dana's here with me to talk about it. Full disclosure, I worked with Dana on the book, so today's show promises to be very, I guess I'll say, mutually nostalgic. Hi, Dana.
Hi there.
I'm so happy you're here. Today was the first time I got to actually see the printed book in person, so you'll have to forgive me if I'm distracted by looking at it. I can't believe a year ago, I think it was exactly a year ago, we were in a photo studio, I think.
That's right. It was such an incredibly rewarding process to, you know, have ideas about food, and then, Julia, to have you bring them to life. So I feel like you're my midwife. You're my foodie midwife. So
I think I need a new business card.
I can see the sketch that goes with that. Birthing big books. Big, beautiful books. Big, bouncing books. Anyway.
We'll work on that
books. So, yeah, and then after you and I had worked out the recipes, it was so much fun to get into the studio with John Koenig and with Susie Theodoro to make the recipes as beautiful as they could be for the book. And I cannot believe it's been a year. People keep saying, how long did it take you? I'm like, I don't know. It seems both like it took me 20 minutes and it took me 5 years.
Yeah, but no, that's, I feel that way about any kind of big project I've worked on where it always feels like just yesterday and then also like, oh my God, that was a while ago. Speaking of the photography team that you just mentioned, I think you had like one of the greatest teams, and the book looks beautiful. I wish John and Susie were with us today.
But let's hope they can listen to us just talk about them, because yeah, we couldn't say all this stuff in front of them.
That's so funny. I want to talk about the origin of the book and go way back. How did you first come up with the idea?
So the book is called Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen because I really have a lot to learn. I had a lot to learn, and I still do. I grew up in a non-food family. Nobody cooked. My mother didn't cook. My father didn't cook. My grandmothers didn't cook. The grandmothers way back in the old country, I imagine they must have cooked something, but they didn't hand down any recipes. So I'm exposed to chefs and cooking and great food every single day of my life. And that actually allowed me to never learn how to cook.
That's so funny.
But I do love having people over. I do love entertaining. So I would cook for people, and I'd cook for them all the time. And every time I would cook, I would do something wrong. And like headbangingly wrong. Like not a little bit wrong, but like stupid wrong. And again, you know, they were well fed. They went home happy, I imagine. And that might have been the wine, which is, you know, part of a meal as well. But I decided I was just a little sick of it, and it had never really occurred to me that I could get better until I just got so sick of making these mistakes. I'm like, actually, there are cooking classes. I do know some people who know how to cook. In fact, I know a lot of great chefs who could teach me how to cook.
Yeah, I think you know a few.
I know a few. And so I reached out, getting over the initial sense of humiliation and embarrassment that I was going to go to Dave Chang and Thomas Keller and Tom Colicchio and Mario Batali and say, you're not going to believe this, but I really need your help. I don't know how to cook. So will you help me with these recipes? And they were so generous. And they actually, it was sort of split. Some of the chefs said, I'm sure you're not really making mistakes. You know, there are no mistakes to be made. And then the other half of the chefs who said, yeah, you know, I totally understand. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. Let me help you out.
Sure.
And you know, all the chefs did end up helping, but it amused me that the different points of view.
Would you say, was there any, I don't know, like aha moment for you? Because I think it's a very, I mean, there's a humorous bent to the book, but it's a really sort of humbling cookbook. And it sounds like you went from realizing you were someone who not only made mistakes, but you were someone who was willing to talk about them. And so when did you realize that these sort of quote unquote failures were really sort of material for a great book? When did you make that turn?
I think that the idea that I had a lot of funny stories that I knew, because every time something happened, you know, it was a comedy of errors. So I felt that the book could be engaging and funny from that perspective, and making a very relatable book, because I don't think I'm the only person who, you know, burns the underside of vegetables while the top is raw, and I'm probably not the only person who has like oversalted a pesto to an inedible degree, and I'm, you know, so I thought there was a sort of shareability about it, and so I think that I was hoping that between admitting the mistakes and sharing them and correcting them, which is also a great value,
sure,
to people,
yeah,
that there would be something that people would want to read. And selfishly, I thought, look, even if I'm the only person who learned something, I'll have, you know, achieved my goal. I will have learned a few things just by going through this process,
absolutely,
observing the mistakes that I made. And some people said to me, well, you know, how do you know you're going to make a mistake? Like, and I'm like, I know. Like, I just know.
If I know one thing.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of these mistakes. I want to talk, if you're willing to, about some of your more embarrassing ones. Are there any in particular that you, now that the book is printed, we're looking at it, it's sitting right here, is there any story in the book that you sort of feel like you can't believe you actually admitted? Is there?
Well, the one that I sort of feel the worst about, perhaps, is, you know, when I made an animal suffer. And that that mistake was when I was just out of college, and I was in the kitchen with my mother, the OG non-cook. And we had lobsters. And I don't know why we had lobsters. Like, I was trying to go back in my memory, like, why were we in the kitchen with a pot of boiling boiling water and live lobsters? We like lobster, but we also eat lobster out, in any case. So my mother decided I should put the lobster in the pot, and I foolishly agreed. And I put the lobster in the pot tail first. Well, what ensued was grabby little claws jumping up over the top of the pot. And it was a horrible sight. And I ran in one direction. My mother ran in the other direction until those claws just subsided, you know, down into the pot. And I feel terrible about that. So it's not like maybe the stupidest mistake I made, but just it wasn't good.
Sure. It's so interesting that these mistakes are like, it sounds like they became an interesting way for you to kind of collect a bunch of memories too, and to go back to meals with your mother or whoever it might be. And
well, in fact, it was really interesting because you'd think that maybe the mistakes that I was making were of a more recent variety, but in fact, they
You've
go back.
You've been making mistakes forever.
I have been. I mean, my first, you know, I was very good at cooking a pot of rice. That I was good at, but you know,
that's so interesting to me
because
I think
back,
that's can be, even for very skilled chefs, a pretty difficult thing to do in a funny way, even though it's like such a sort of basic food of so many cultures. And
yeah, I think because I had someone who made white rice in college and chicken broth, and they made it every single week. And for whatever reason, that's a talent I had. but you know, my first memory in the kitchen, you know, most people's first memory is something just endearing, like how they made the cake, and it really impressed their mother, and then their mother made them do it for guests. My first memory is making popcorn. I still like viscerally remember the pan because it had a brass colored top, and it was a really beat up pan, and I made popcorn in the pan as opposed to Jiffy Pop. So that was a step, that was an advancement for mankind. But when I was done with the pan, it didn't occur to me that putting the pan on the countertop, which was for Micah, it would explode.
It exploded?
It exploded. Not the pan. but the formica.
Oh my God.
From the hot pan. So I go way back with the mistakes. And they do. And in fact, I was reliving that mistake with a grade school friend. And she said, you know, I was there. And I'm like, I actually didn't remember you were there. And she said, yeah, you know what else? Not only was I there, but you said that I should tell your mother that I put the pan on the formica countertop. Oh boy.
So the book has you sort of taking responsibility.
It does. Exactly. It's all about taking responsibility.
That is so funny. Let's talk a little bit about solutions. The book includes advice from 65 chefs. What were some of the most valuable lessons you learned from them during the process?
The chefs were so, so generous. And I think that some of the lessons were very big picture. Like, you know, you think that you can just sort of cook and do three things at once. And I live a lot of my life sort of doing three things at once. I think we all do. But until you get really good, you should actually just cook. You know, you should stay present in the moment and you should, like, focus on what you're doing. So if you're, for example, trying to kill a lobster in a new and humane way, you need to really focus on the tip of the knife, which is something that Eric Repair showed me how to do. But some of the things were the simplest. It really does bother me that I can't get my roasted root vegetables to cook evenly mm-hmm. every time. And April Bloomfield helped me with that. And she suggested putting, doubling up the pans. So a pan under the pan to mitigate the heat. And she also recommends sort of paying attention to what your vegetables are. So if they're dense and they're going to take longer to cook, then you cook them smaller. And if a vegetable, and you're going to cook these vegetables at the same time, cook a vegetable that has more liquid and it's going to cook more quickly at a larger size. So they do cook simultaneously and you don't end up with burnt, overcooked, undercooked. And also there's a lot of stuff that I just, you know, I feel like I'm a lazy cook. Like that's the value of this book is like, you're talking to someone who's really a lazy cook. I don't like to clean up a lot of dishes. I don't like to have a lot of ingredients. I don't like to go to a specialty store. So the recipes are amazing. But they're quite simple. So the things that I'm messing up are quite simple as well.
I thought it was an interesting process asking the chefs for advice because as opposed to asking them necessarily just for recipes, you're sort of telling them stories about things you had made mistakes when you attempted to make them. So you're essentially asking chefs to troubleshoot, which I think is it's a slightly similar but different question. And I think for someone like, you know, that example with the vegetables with April and her response to that, and it's really learning about these ingredients in and out. So as opposed to just roasting anything you might have, hoping it'll turn out a certain way, she sort of encourages like a bigger understanding of, you know, the ingredients you're working with. So,
and April actually was very interesting because her solution in a, I gave the most practical advice, but her real advice is, you know, you cook them on the stove first and you like baby them and take care of them before you put them in the oven. And that's an extra step. And so sometimes you go to chefs and they do it the perfect way,
sure.
But the perfect way involves more work than I'm willing
to
do.
I always think, but they also have dishwashers and,
and they have people chopping.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. That's so funny. I'm so curious now that you're a more seasoned home cook, you've been through this whole process, you've gotten all this advice. Do you find yourself now at all disagreeing with any of the advice you've been given? Has that happened?
I'm not that bold. No. I mean, I did think some, you know, from time to time, okay, this is great advice, but I am too lazy or I'm okay with doing a shortcut or, cause I'm really more of a shortcut cook. But I think that the recipes that we did together, they sort of took that into account, that the chefs might do things sort of with four steps, but you really could collapse a few of those
sure,
steps.
Yeah. I think it was sort of taking kind of the best of from all the advice and really understanding it for like a home cook. And, you know, I think the roasted vegetables are a good example of that. The book also includes a number of totally foolproof recipes, sort of no-fail recipes. Tell us a little bit more about those and the origin of those ones.
Okay. The no-fail is really great. It's not getting a whole lot of attention in discussing the book because they're not funny. But I do cook all the time, and there are things you truly just cannot screw up. And for example, I eat very healthily, and there's a lot of salads in the book that are just really you're just chopping. You know, you're.
I feel like those four kind of super crunchy salads, they're some of my favorites. And
you're chopping tossed crunchy things. So, right, I love this recipe that's based on one from Deborah Madison, where you have hard winter vegetables, like cauliflower chopped up, and then with salty things like capers and olives, and you know, more wispy things like a celery leaf, and you just chop them, and they're infinitely variable because you're just trying to get a variety of flavors all chopped up and tossed together, and that's very freeing because you really don't have to think. You just like it's sort of fridge bin cooking. You look, you see what we have, what is not wilted, chop it up
like
and toss it together.
You already have the title for like many title opportunities for your next book, the fridge bin cook or the short cook. I want to talk a little bit about how things have changed for you after writing the book, namely what you're cooking at home now. Are you cooking more often?
Well, I'm cooking pretty much the same because I'm a person who cooks to entertain. Mm-hmm. Sadly for my family, you know, cooking for them, just four of us, I don't do that so much. Or they get, you know, pasta with tomato sauce. They get the fastest, simplest version, or salad. My daughter actually has taken over as the soup cook. And she loves soup. My son loves soup. So I think partly as a result of the book, the weird thing is my daughter's more empowered. She's 14.
That's so interesting.
And she watched me make these mistakes, and she's watched me correct them. And she's watched a lot of food TV.
Yeah.
And she feels like she can do it better. So we had a cauliflower soup cook-off. And no joke, she won. That was it. That was her moment, and she has relived the cooking moment ever since. And I continue to cook for between 10 and 20 people, which is cooking to entertain, mm-hmm. Which I love to do. But it turns out that my 14-year-old is now going to be the household cook.
Well, maybe she's learned from all your mistakes so she doesn't have to repeat them.
She has no fear, and she has very good instincts.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
I remember when we were working on the recipes for the book and being with you and your family, and we had a grilled cheese cook-off, and I was very nervous because she like clearly knows. I mean, she's got taste.
And, she's very particular.
Yeah. That's so funny. How have your feelings about making mistakes changed since working on the book? What's your sort of philosophy of mistakes?
I have to admit that before doing the book about mistakes, I hadn't cataloged how many I'd made in how many different areas. And now the change is I view the mistakes more as learning opportunities. And before I used to just view mistakes as irritations. And it's kind of changed my life.
I was about to say, it sounds like a big metaphor. Yeah.
It was just gigantic. I mean, I have a couple of things that I haven't done because I've been afraid of them or my time had passed, you know, like why learn to cook, you know, when you're over 50, like just don't bother. But actually it's really fun to do. And it's really fun to have this idea that if you're just because you're not good at naturally good at something doesn't mean you can't get good at something.
Absolutely.
And so the couple of the big changes. I mean, yesterday, for example, I was jumping on a trampoline and my kids told me to do like a front flip. I'm like, no way. I am not doing a front flip. And my son said, I can teach you. I'm like, okay, you're so not teaching me how to do a front flip. But then I thought, you know what? Like my whole philosophy is I can learn it. I can learn it. So it was more like a roll than a flip. But I did
get
my...
But you went for it.
But I did.
Wow.
I went, you know, head first and flipped over and...
Where was this trampoline?
It was outside. It was in the country by our little farmhouse. And probably the biggest thing that I'm conquering is I don't drive because I grew up in New York City. And, you know, we'll see how far it goes, but I'm taking on the driving.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's pretty great. I love how that has sort of translated to more than just the kitchen for you. That's a really, I think it's an important lesson, and there's a lot of humor to it, but it's also pretty inspiring. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be right back with, I'm sure, plenty more mistakes.
Boys and girls are on fire.
Today's program has been brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit www.surifarms.com.
I'm Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sarah Kamen.
And we're the hosts of The Morning After. You're listening to
Heritage
Radio
Network
dot
org.
Hi, and welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm your host, Julia Tertian, and I'm back with Dana Cowan. I was just hearing about Dana's recent trampoline excursion. Has the book, so you're now sort of working on the driving.
Yes.
That's so funny. Has the book translated into any other department, or sort of you're on the road now?
I think so far, just the big idea that you can learn things is what I've taken on. And I've been very, very, very lucky in that for most of my career and most of my life, there have been things that I naturally gravitate towards that I'm pretty good at and that I get rewarded for doing things that I'm already good at. But if you do, and I learn something every single day in doing something that I'm already good at. And so I kind of had left it at that. Like, that seemed good enough for me. But the big lesson here is if there's something that you're not good at, it can be worth trying. I'm not saying that I could conquer everything I'm not good at. For example, I have a terrible singing voice. I will never be a good singer, and I'm not going to try. I would love to learn to draw. But again, I think you need some inherent talent there, perhaps. So, maybe in 20 years I'll tackle the drawing. So it doesn't apply to absolutely everything. I'm not sort of mindlessly going to take on things.
Sure.
But for things that they actually take some training.
Yeah.
I've been a lazy learner because there have been enough things that I am good at that I could be lazy about things that I wasn't good at.
Sure. That makes sense. Well, it's great to have a new willingness for
yes.
all sorts of things. I was hoping to sort of contextualize the book a bit in terms of your career, as you were just talking about. And I was thinking from even coming up with the concept of the book to writing it, developing recipes, creating the photographs. These are things that you work on a daily basis at the magazine. How is the cookbook process for you compared to the magazine process?
I really, really loved it. The process of putting together a cookbook. I love the process of putting together a magazine, and they're very, very similar. I think for every story in Food Wine magazine, it starts with a coherent idea. And we poke at ideas at Food and Wine and poke at them and poke at them and poke at them until we have something that we feel really will hold the reader's attention, but also that makes sense and hasn't been done before. And so with the developing of the idea of the book, it actually went along in the same process, which was I knew that I did want to learn to cook. That seemed like a great project, but I didn't exactly know how. And so I poked at it and poked at it. And I had an agent who poked at it until we came up with an idea that I felt was pretty solid. At the magazine, I work with the art department on how a story will be realized. What is it going to look like in the pictures? Who's the right photographer to carry out that idea? And with the book, it was the same thing, picking a photographer who seemed well-suited. They had to be able to shoot perfect food, but then they also had to be able to shoot the interaction between me and the chefs, because we shot with Mara Batali and Dave Chang and Jean-Georges Van Richten and Joanne Chang and Alex Gordon-Shelley. So, getting the right team, having the right person do the rest with me, you, and I'm having Susie Theodoro bring those ideas into sort of three dimensions that then turn into two dimensions. That was so important, having the right team. That's something that I really know so fully from mm-hmm. the magazine. And that was part of what made this book so much fun. Of having such amazing, incredible collaborators. I had an incredible editor in Dan Halpern at Echo. He was enthusiastic, encouraging, gentle, kind. I couldn't have had a better editor. And that's funny because I don't have an editor at the magazine.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
It's just me.
Yeah.
So you know,
how
I mean,
did that go for you?
There's a huge amount of exchange between me and the editors. But in general, if the editors will often say, no, you're wrong to me, which is great. I actually love having an editor. The process of writing the book was really interesting because I wrote all the head notes, and I don't do that much writing. I write an editor's letter. I write I write tweets, 140 characters a time. Yes. Or, you know, parts of Instagram posts. But I have never done this much storytelling. Mm-hmm. And so I felt really great about the stories that I was telling, but I was quite inside my own head. And so I had an editor, Cheryl Hauser, who looked at every single word and helped me shape those stories. And that was a great experience. I love being edited. And at the magazine, I have a great editor, Pam Kaufman, who helps me shape things. So that was not unusual, but writing that many stories.
Sure.
Yeah. That was a lot.
You're a very funny writer. I just want to add that. No, I think the stories in the book are just like, not only do they tell, you know, great moments of learning lessons, and there's sort of an educational element to them, but they're really, I mean, they're like laugh out loud funny. So that comes through. Anyway, go on, please.
Oh, no, just so, and then the design, you know, it was great to work on the design. At Food & Wine, I oversee the way the design, the photographs and the words type come together. And so that was very familiar to me. And in fact, Patricia Sanchez at the magazine helped it do a template. So it's quite a blending of my worlds.
Sure,
actually.
Yeah, big time. Did writing the book and creating it in any way, has it changed the way you do anything at the magazine?
Not yet. It hasn't made me write more, I'll tell you that. And
there's now a trampoline in your office.
That would be great. Yeah. Ping pong table first, I think.
That's so funny. Speaking of the magazine, I was thinking, while I have you here, and because it's Radio Cherry Bomb, after all, I wanted to mention the wonderful list that you worked on with Fortune magazine of the most innovative women in food and drink. It's an eclectic list of 25 women who have played key roles in redefining how we think about food. Can you tell us a little bit about what inspired the list and the process of creating it?
Yes. So at the magazine, we think that we highlight women and men equally. We don't put, we haven't put an enormous amount of thought into, you know, are there more women being represented? Are there more men being represented? But over the last few years, Food & Wine has gotten a lot of pushback, much in social media, some in print, for not highlighting women chefs enough, particularly in our Best New Chef list, which comes out once a year. And for many years, there's been a little bit of buzz about that. And I always dismissed it because I said that I believe that the number of women on that list are representative of the number of women proportionally in the top jobs who would be eligible. So proportionally, that list is actually quite representative of reality. But I began to stop being quite so obstinate and listen a little bit harder. And Jody Adams at Rialto in Boston really brought it home to me. And when I went and did a panel with her, and she said that women aren't in the picture. And I just began to feel, even if I believed that we were representing what was going on in the chef's world, I was doing a disservice to women in the industry for not fighting harder to represent them. And so it was the beginning of thinking, okay, what can we do? You know, if it's a problem, let's address the problem. Okay, it's fine. I might, you know, it's not about who's right or who's wrong, but how can we really make a change? This is, and I took on the notion that it was actually a problem. So Fortune magazine is also owned by Time Inc., as Food & Wine is. And I went to the editor and said, can we do a list together? And we came up with the most innovative women in food and drink. And it was fantastic to create a list that was not only women chefs, because in fact, the idea is that women are changing food in so many different arenas. They're activists, they're know, they're farmers, they're at food companies, they're marketers, they're in the wine business, they're international, they have big businesses, they have small businesses, but women are innovating, and I wanted to bring those women to light. It was a fantastic project to do with them, and it is the, you know, it's the beginning for us. We'll do that as an annual list.
Oh, that's great.
And Food and Wine's also doing a January issue that is devoted to amazing women in the world of food and wine, because it seems like they're definitely, we can do more.
Awesome.
And so we'll use our megaphone.
That's great. Yeah, I think it's so super. And I think the list is amazing also because it takes us, you know, both into the kitchen, but also out of it. And there's amazing women on the list doing really important work. That's great. Another sort of beyond the book question, I was just curious about, as someone who's been at the helm of a major magazine for over two decades now, you know, the author of a new book, these are both, you know, print materials. What's your current status report on print media? What are your feelings?
I think that what you're really looking at, at least in my world, is a multimedia brand, and one execution of it is in print, and the oldest execution of it is in print. And I think that print is something that people really value, particularly in the food world. I think we're very, very lucky in the food world because, you know, as is Cherry Bomb, a magnificent, gorgeous, incredible magazine to look at, to read, to hold. It's an amazing object. I think that print sort of becomes an object and is valued as, you know, something to be treasured or shared, you know, something that is relaxing. But what at the core of Food and Wine is a brand and an idea about celebrating great talent and all chefs and winemakers and artisans, and taking the idea of the talent and the way that they intersect with our world, allowing us to make delicious meals that we can share with family and friends, pointing us to fantastic restaurants that we could go to, fantastic places to travel. So I feel like if you look at it holistically, you're looking at print as one spoke on a very round wheel that will keep on turning.
Keeps turning.
Yeah.
Awesome. And speaking of sort of bringing print to life, tell us a little bit about what's going on to help celebrate the cookbook, and what kind of events have you been doing and will you be doing?
I'm so excited to tomorrow to be doing a blogger potluck. And where, Julia, what are you making? Oh, I know what you're making.
I'm making naan.
Okay. So, Julia, you failed at
naan.
But why did your naan fail?
So the story behind the recipe is the original recipe was based on some notes from a new cookbook that I'm helping to work on, which is with Hot Bread Kitchen, which is an amazing organization. And it's a bakery / sort of workforce development program. And the book includes, to make a long story short, a number of baking recipes and things to go along with it. So the naan came from that. And the first time I attempted it was based on some notes. And I am not a very experienced bread baker. And so I looked at the first notes and I thought, like, I don't know how this is going to turn out just based on what I know. But because I thought maybe wherever these notes came from, maybe whoever created them knew way more than I did. So I was like,
they knew a good shortcut.
So let me just try this and see. And I made the dough, which was really more of a batter. And I thought, like, I'm not going to be able to shape this in the way that I think I'm supposed to. And so I was just left with this bowl of fermenting dough, essentially. And I literally was nervous to throw it out because there was such a high amount of yeast in this that it kept growing. I literally thought if I put it in my trash can, it's gonna be like your lobster coming out of it. So I just baked it because I figured if nothing else, I'll stop it from going. And it was the smartest thing I ever did. I thought I made like this gorgeous, huge, oversized biscuit. And then as it cooled down, all of its sort of promising qualities went with it. And it just deflated into like an awful thing. Anyway, we worked on the recipe. This is the importance of recipe development and testing. I now am in possession of a great naan recipe. So I'm excited.
But what do you think went wrong? Like too much yeast or wrong ratio of water to...
Yeah, I think just way too much liquid in general. And it's a really rich dough that has I don't have it in front of me, but I'm pretty sure from memory it's got yogurt, milk, and ghee in it. So, like, three really rich ingredients, all essentially liquid ingredients. And so by the time those all came into play, plus the flour and everything else, it was just... It was a lot.
I think it's just fascinating because at Food and Wine in the test kitchen, they troubleshoot recipes all the time. You know, you get something in, you're suspicious that it won't quite be right, but you want to test it the chef's way because they know so much. And then...
And every now and then you're pleasantly surprised and you're like, oh, I never thought something like this would work. And it does.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you've got this amazing chef trick. Yeah. But then you have to figure out how to troubleshoot it, which is why you're so incredibly talented to be able to troubleshoot that and fix it.
But, you know, even with that said, and thank you, it's sometimes you do have to fail to not fail.
Right.
For sure.
Anyway, so the blogger potluck. So the exciting thing about the blogger potluck, some of my very, very favorite bloggers in the whole world are going to come, and they're each going to bring a dish that they once failed, but they've now mastered. So we get to share stories because, as I said, I don't think I'm the only person who's had fails galore and then fixed them. And so Phoebe Lapine from Feed Me Phoebe and you, Julia, are helping put together the list. And it's just a bunch of great women, as it turns out, all women. And then I'm going to do an Instagram meetup where we get to shoot some food with Daniel Krieger, and then I'm going to go on a book tour.
Awesome. That's really exciting. It's so cool, I think, how much you're engaging with all these different ways of promoting the book that are, you know, just beyond normal print promotion, and I think it speaks to a lot of what we were talking about, and I know I'm so excited for this to come out, and it's been so exciting to see it today. Before we run out of time for today, I have to do the Cherry Bomb Rapid Fire Q&A with you, so... no pressure, but it's the 7 questions we ask every guest who comes on, and I cannot wait to hear your answers. So, Dana, 1, sweet or salty?
Sweet.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
Coffee. How do you take your coffee?
Milky. And sugar.
If I were to look into your refrigerator at home right now, what might I be surprised to find?
Surprised? I don't know. An amazing caviar from Passmore in California.
Awesome. What about the refrigerators at Food and Wine? Anything unusual in there these days?
In my little mini fridge that is by my desk, my white mini fridge, I have those little red wrapped Bon Bell things. It's crazy. As well as some really nice Gruyere and some Bocconcini. And I just really like milk products.
My next question is, what's your go-to snack? Does it relate to
they relate that. Yes, but it's popcorn, actually.
Popcorn, the infamous popcorn. What's your favorite time of day?
The morning.
And where do you want to travel to next?
Japan.
What was your favorite meal when you were a kid?
Grilled cheese.
The cheese
is the cheese, sorry, yeah.
The string through your life.
But no string cheese, yeah.
Dana, thanks so much for coming on the show today. I just want to plug all of your online handles and sites and everything. So your personal Twitter account is FW Scout.
Yes.
And the book has its own feed, which is at Kitchen Mistakes.
Yes.
And more about the book, events coming up to celebrate its release, where to buy it, et cetera, are all on masteringmymistakes.com.
Exactly.
Okay, great.
And I would love people to go on that site. I did it, and then I thought, oh my gosh, is anyone ever going to come here? No one goes to websites anymore. Don't I know that? But it does have the tour information, and it has a post about Julia Churchin, who's such a great collaborator, and Susie Theodoro, who's a fantastic food stylist, but also did props, and many more. You actually, Julia, can see my childhood kitchen and this fabulous South Bend stove that has been there for 52 years.
No way.
That has been there since my mother moved in, but predated her, since the only thing she can cook is instant coffee.
We should add I think one of my favorite recipes in the book is your mother's, what do we end up calling it?
I don't know, remember. Her black and white soda.
So you have to buy the book to find the answer, but I think it speaks to your heritage. While you're online checking out Mastering My Mistakes, everything about Food and Wine is at foodandwine.com.
Yes.
And as always, thank you everyone for listening. Tune in next Monday at 1:00 for another new episode of Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage _Radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.